The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
You're listening to Nightmare on Film Street. The current time is 6:66. Traffic is clear ahead from here to the afterlife, but it's hell outside. For the next hour, you're on Nightmare Time. So, let's give a grave welcome to our hosts, John and Kim.
Hello again, fiends, and welcome back to Bob Clark's Creepy Christmas Spooktacular, hosted by Nightmare on Film Street, the horror movie podcast of the casually obsessed. There are too many goddamn words at the beginning of this show.
You were the one that made it this weird variety show.
100% my fault. I'm John.
I'm Kim.
And welcome to Nightmare on Film Street's variety show that we're calling Uncle Bob Clark's Creepy Christmas Spooktacular. It is a variety show of sorts, similar to last week's episode. We've got another musical number for you. We've got a perfect cocktail pairing for the movie we're talking about today. Kim's gonna show us one of her secret talents live on the radio tonight. Can't wait. There might even be an appearance from the Morbid Tabernacle Choir. Courtesy in honor, in memoriam for Barb. We're talking about Bob Clark's Black Christmas today. A proto, the proto slasher of all proto slashers.
What does proto mean?
Proto means that slashers had not necessarily come out.
Oh, it's like prototype.
Yes, like exactly.
It made the mold.
Yeah, it didn't perfect it, but it really helped introduce us to it. So sometimes you gotta sand the edges on these things.
No, I think fucking Black Christmas is it.
Man, that's the thing.
Episode over. Thanks, guys. Thank you so much for coming.
How is it that in 1974, we got the two best proto-slashers ever made?
What's the other one?
Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, shit.
They came. It's so funny, because watching this, I was in my head, I kept thinking that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre had come out the year before. And like, oh, that's so great, because I really think that there's like one key scene in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre that Bob Clark probably like really grabbed onto for building Billy. And nope, they came out within like weeks apart of each other.
Wow. 1974 gave us the quintessential summer horror and the quintessential winter horror.
Yeah.
Not even slashers. Like, I'm just talking about like the best of the best.
Yeah. If you could watch this in any particular order, I would say like this would be a great night at the drive-in, and the order makes zero sense. But I think this is the order to watch them in. First up, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Second feature, Black Christmas. Third feature, bonus feature, Saturday only, Halloween. Now, they seem like obvious pairings, but I do think they're all doing something very interesting that I think is very similar, especially in how they regard their killer.
Does this have anything to do with the discussion we're having tonight on Black Christmas?
I mean, it might, so perhaps I should hold it. Yes, this is part two of our Christmas variety show. Last week, we were talking about Bob Clark's Death Dream family classic.
Slash Dead of Night.
Family classic. A perfect movie if you're going home for the holidays, whether you're going home.
It's not a holiday movie at all. Let's just give it up. Let's just move along here on the train.
Okay, fine. This week's episode, pure Christmas through and through.
Oh, so Christmas.
It's in the title. Undeniably. And of course, not the first time that we've talked about this movie on the podcast. I mean, heck, I think it was last year, maybe 2 years ago, we recorded, maybe it was like 3 years ago at this point where we recorded a live.
Time is but a
Yeah, we recorded a live commentary track for the movie. We've talked about it before. We made that awful mistake that lots of podcasters do in their first year where they just come out talking about all their favorites and all the hits. Like, oh, that's great.
Yeah, about all the best films with the worst audio quality.
Yeah, really, while you're cutting your teeth, while you're figuring out your show, let's burn all the hits down.
Yeah, you don't know all of the words that you overutilize and need to cut that shit out of.
Oh, I mean, 5 years on, I'm still saying the same shit.
Oh, yeah, I've learned nothing.
But yeah, was like our fifth episode, we were like, let's do John Carpenter's Halloween and Bob Clark's Black Christmas. What a great double bill. This is going to be so great. We're never going to have new thoughts and revelations on these movies down the road. But with that in mind, Kim, what are your three good things for Black Christmas?
Well, I think the number one good thing, and is kind of a given for the theme of the episode, the theme of the film, is that it is so Christmassy.
Yeah.
It evokes the Christmas feeling. It's got that warm and cozy, but also that it's cold outside, blustery, windy. Warm nog.
Yeah, okay, yep, there was more.
Gift sharing, lights, decorations, friends. Christmas.
Was this a poem that you wrote for your good thing number one?
I'm done now.
Okay. good thing number two. I've seen this movie 100 times. I truly don't know who the killer is. This is a whodunit that never tells you whodunit. I'm still like...
Is that a spoiler?
No. I didn't say... How can you spoil an ambiguous ending?
I don't know.
Kim is drunk tonight.
I'm recovering from a cold. I haven't slept well. I'm on a lot of medication.
Yeah. It comes through.
I took a bunch of Gravol. I wasn't feeling good.
Right on. Is that what the kids are doing nowadays? Just take a handful of Gravol and
see
what happens?
I wasn't feeling good.
This is the 2023 lewd. Like, take a bunch of Gravol and try and podcast.
Oh, this is a mess.
Good thing number three.
What was good thing number two? Oh, yeah.
What was good thing number two? I'm going to take over. I'm going to say good thing number three, and I think we can all appreciate this, regardless of where you live when you're watching the movie. This features some of the best Canadian accents ever. And what I love about it, too, is that, especially when you look it up on Wikipedia, like, Black Christmas, the 1974 Canadian slasher directed by Bob Clark. Canada just took this as their own. They were like, those are our voices! And, like, yes, they used some Canadian tax credits to make the movie.
It's
you see how defensive Kim is? Kim, a Canadian, was just like, well, what do you mean it's not Canadian?
They filmed it in Toronto.
Yeah.
It's set at the University of Toronto.
With an American crew. And an Australian lead. And is set in America.
Margot Kidder's Canadian, I think.
You think. Honorary at best.
So is Art Handel, yeah, I think.
Anyway.
Just based on the way he says oat.
Very clear. It's,
and Bob Clark loves Canada.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
As we learned in our last episode, when he moved from Florida to Canada and became Canadian.
And you can get a whole bunch of unfettered access to Canadian accents in this movie. It's great.
And there's hockey. They play hockey.
That's how Canadian it is. Those are three good things from people who have seen this movie 100,000 times. We watch it every year. I watch it in the summer sometimes, and I'm probably bound to watch it 2 to 3 times every Christmas. I love Black Christmas. If you've never seen it before, I mean, I don't know if those three good things are 100% going to sell you on it, but like, if you've never seen Black Christmas and you like slashers, I highly encourage you to check this one out, because it came out at a time before the killer POV and before the whodunit nature of every 80s slasher that you've probably already seen. It's so interesting to watch a movie that was doing its own thing. It's definitely pulling from like Italian thrillers like giallos. At a time when giallos were still pretty new, to be perfectly honest. And it's great to see somebody creating the formula and doing something so unique and original with it, you know, 10 years before it became the template for a slasher.
Yeah, because the whole thing with a whodunit is you're performing a magic trick. You are doing sleight of hand. You're showing hints. Everything is being done in front of your eyes, and you don't see it until the very end. And That's what's so wonderful about slashers and whodunits and murder mysteries. And Black Christmas is so fucking good at it.
Yeah, and so many sassy characters in this. Everybody's just full of sass, especially Margot Kidder. We're going to cut to the trailer, and when we come back, we're going to get in full discussion on Bob Clark's Black Christmas. But before we go, we have our first segment, our little cocktail corner, something to get you in the mood, a little rosy-cheeked for a holiday horror movie. We tossed this at the end of last week's episode, but I think it might not be a bad idea to drop it in now. especially given the energy of the show. This is a little drink we're calling the House Mother's Little Secret. Now, it's a sherry-based cocktail, which is not typically the foundational alcohol for a standard cocktail, but it's the holiday season, so we can get a little creep, we can get a little crazy, you know, no big deal. Now, the tricky thing about sherry is that you want it to be cool and cold, but not chilled. You don't want to leave it in the freezer. That's going to make it too cold. The refrigerator's not
perfect. So you're saying the back of a toilet bowl.
I think the perfect temperature is in the back of a toilet bowl. You just pop the lid on that little sucker, drop her in 15 minutes before you're getting ready to serve the drink. Don't forget about it. Otherwise, that's going to be weird. You know, if you're worried about fishing it out, you don't want to put your hand in the back of the toilet bowl. Now, keep in mind, that's clean water. You just tie a little... I'm not saying drink it. You just tie a little string around the top of that bottle, plop her on down, hoist her back up when it's time to go, and you really... The crucial part about this drink...
How is this a cocktail?
The crucial part about the House Mother's Little Secret is keeping that temperature consistent. Now, this is nitpicky, of course, but, you know, unless your vessel, your glass, your coupe, whatever you're putting your drink in, isn't the exact same temperature as the sherry, you're going to throw this drink off completely. And obviously, I'm not suggesting you put a cup in the back of the toilet bowl. That'd be insane. So I think best for this one is you just want to pour yourself a little ounce and a half directly in your mouth. You don't want to put this in a cup whatsoever. You're just going to take a quick little nibble after you've taken it out of the back of the toilet bowl. Now, as garnish, this is optional and unconventional, I'll say. But this, don't forget, this is how Mrs. McHenry takes her cocktail. You might want to just like a half a teaspoon of toothpaste, swish that around in your mouth at the same time. Now that seems crazy, and you're like, oh, I'm not gonna like this. But what is toothpaste but mint? It's festive time season. You're gonna get yourself a nice little Christmas flavoring on your House Mother's Little Secret.
Is the gift that keeps on giving.
It really is.
Because if you keep that bottle in the toilet bowl, it keeps on giving.
Yeah, and it's definitely a lot better than the bottle that you keep hidden in a shoebox in the closet or in a hollowed out book in the library. Surely there's probably also one
in your
bag.
How has Barb not found that book yet?
Well, Barb definitely, I think, found the one in the closet. That's why it was empty. But that's the House Mother's Little Secret. We're going to toss the trailer when we get back. Bob Clark's Creepy Christmas Spooktacular continues!
A high school girl's been murdered. Mr. Harrison's daughter is missing. And now at the house where she lives, the other girls are getting obscene phone calls.
Yeah, what I've done is I've tapped this phone so that when it rings, it'll ring at the station house, too.
There was a little girl murdered over in the park tonight.
Yes, I heard.
Your phone's ringing.
Terminal 55.
Remember those idyllic scenes out of your childhood? Crisp winter nights, star bright, sleigh bells crackling Yule logs, candlelight glistening off of shimmering Christmas trees, chestnuts roasting over open fires, carolers beneath snow-covered window ledges. Remember those? Remember them well. After Black Christmas, they'll never be the same again. Black Christmas, starring Olivia Hussey Keir Dulay, Margot Kidder, and starring John Saxon as Lieutenant Fuller. If this movie doesn't make your skin crawl, it's on too tight.
Uncle Bob's Black Christmas is currently sitting at a 7.1 out of 10 on IMDb, a 72% on Rotten Tomatoes, and a 3.8 out of 5 on Letterboxd. It will also not surprise you to learn that Gene Siskel hated it. He thought it was as derivative as any other horror movie, despite being incredibly unique. Like, goddamn.
Did he say it was unique?
No, he didn't.
He's... Was he like, it's incredibly unique?
No, he was just like, you know, it's just another one of these fucking movies. Like, it's completely unlike anything else that was coming out in 1974. And he's like, seen it. This isn't Saturday Night Fever. I hate it. Actually, his favorite movie, by the way. It's fun to poke fun at Gene Siskel because he also loved John Carpenter's The Thing. So he had taste at the very least.
Sometimes.
Hated slashers. That's just what it came down to. And like, I mean, it was the '70s. It was definitely the heyday of the serial killer. So I could understand why maybe somebody running a rampage through a sorority house left a bad taste in everybody's mouth. Did you happen to read anywhere that was a big problem when this movie went to TV?
The sorority house thing?
Yeah, so this movie was set for television premiere the week that Ted Bundy killed a whole bunch of people.
Oh, God!
Yeah.
And when he did that little escapade?
Escapade? I think we call it a rampage. He went berserk. He murdered a whole bunch of people. And it was awful. And the governor of Florida basically implored NBC to not air it.
That's tasteful.
Yeah, and NBC, I don't think they flat out said no, but they let all of their channels, whoever, distributors... Or repeating the program, the option of playing something else.
Oh, so like make their own call. So like,
yeah. You can't blame
this
us.
Is your fault.
Yeah. There is more true crime history to Black Christmas than I had known about. Turns out that the screenwriter had based this on a real murder that had happened in Montreal.
Oh, really?
Now, obviously,
I feel like that's another point for making it Canadian.
God damn. So the writer is Canadian. All I'm saying is, like, there's American flags in this movie. Like, this movie is set in America.
No, it's not.
It's made by American people.
No, it's not.
But it is 100% a Canadian horror movie.
It gets dark at 4 p.m. It's cold. It's right. Ours.
It's that's the thing. Like, this movie takes place over, I think, 24 hours.
It's dark most of them.
90% of the movie's in blackness. Yeah, they're just like, oh, well, it must be noon. Sun's gone. Yeah, so I got this little quote here from some research I was doing that Black Christmas is based on true occurrence in Westmount, Montreal in November 1943. George Webster...
1943, wow.
Yeah, yeah. George Webster, 14 years old at the time, killed his mother with a baseball bat at home. He also attacked his brother, sister, and a family friend, but they just suffered injuries, didn't die. He was accused of his mother's murder, but judged incompetent to stand trial and was sent to a mental hospital.
Hmm.
So that's I would think he's more of the basis for Billy than anything else. But I also found that he had probably also based this on some weirdo who was known as the Lipstick Killer. He'd killed three women in Chicago between 1945 and 1946 and apparently wrote the words "Stop Me" on the wall in their lipstick.
Mm.
And the original title of the screenplay was Stop Me.
Yeah.
Now that got adapted quite a bit once Bob Clark came on board.
He was like, Christmas.
Yeah, he's like, let's make it Christmas, let's set it at a sorority house, and you know what? Let's, for fun, throw in some humor. Really, by the sounds of it, changed the movie completely. And is the Black Christmas that we know today.
It's really interesting that there is kind of all of this loose source material for the film, because that's maybe one of my favorite things about it, is that when we come into the film, the sorority girls are already familiar with this caller. Like, they've already been receiving these obscene
phone
calls.
They got a nickname
calls.
For it.
They're like, it's the Mona!
And they all come in. They're like, oh shit, he's on the phone again.
Yeah, and the calls are so fucking creepy, because as many times as I've seen this film, I could not tell you 90% of what's being said on the calls. Mm-hmm. And there's something magical about not knowing. Magical in the horror sense.
Yeah, you are, I don't know, it's like looking at a car accident, right? Like, you're just like the girls in the movie. They're very interested. Like, ooh, he's back again. And then immediately they're horrified listening to it.
Because it's so fucking creepy. Like, parts of it are sexualized and creepy. Then there's this weird, maybe multiple personality aspect. There's somebody's reliving a memory or a fantasy.
Yeah, like
there are so many layers of psychology happening here.
Yeah. He's building a world in there. There's yes. a cinematic universe on that phone call.
Which makes sense that the filmmakers are working with a backstory in their heads. They have source material that they've made for this character that mm-hmm. we don't get to learn, which is great.
Yeah.
But I feel like we're coming into a world that exists. And yes. that's something that's so magical about Black Christmas, magical in the horror sense, uh-huh. is that the characters feel so real. The killer feels real. And I feel like I am seeing this Christmas. I feel like I'm seeing this 24-hour period of their lives.
Oh, you're saying that within this 20... Oh, okay.
It feels like a snapshot. It doesn't yeah. feel like I'm watching a movie.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, you've walked into a documentary. And, like, even though you're only seeing 24 hours of their lives, you're getting a whole, huge sense of how the rest of the season has gone.
There's a lot going on. Like, especially, like, main character, Jess, and her boyfriend, Peter, they're dealing with a very serious thing right now. And it's... B plot, really. It's a minor plot. We hear about it through phone calls and two conversations she has with him. In any other movie, unless it was integral to the story, we wouldn't learn all of these details.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't know about Claire and her boyfriend, their relationship, unless it was integral to the plot. But we learn so much about these people, and they get personality traits. Like Phil has a personality, Barb has a personality, and in terms of slasher sense, they are kind of killer fodder.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, they get maybe two things you know about them, and yes. then they're gone.
Yeah.
We wouldn't get to see Barb cracking jokes and having single scenes on her own where she's basically stealing the show for minutes at a time
yeah.
for her to only end up dead. All of the content would go to Jess.
Yes. That's the craziest thing. And so when you were saying that Jess and Peter's sort of love triangle with a baby in it is B plot. I think that about everything in the movie.
There's so much B plot.
Everything is B plot, but it's all happening all at once right here, and you don't necessarily know what's important. It feels like real life where it's not any one particular thing that's important, but it's like all of these things together. I mean, don't get me wrong. At some point, people start getting murdered in the house. That's probably very important, but it's all of this stuff that happens together, which I think is super, super important for when we start trying to talk at the end of the episode about who the killer is and who did what.
Yeah.
Because that is really up in the air.
Like, the audience, like, we are not kept in the dark. We see that Claire is the first murderer. We know she's dead right away.
Oh, yeah. There's no mystery that somebody is killing these people.
But we don't necessarily completely see the full picture. We don't know the entire connection. We know the girls are getting creepy phone calls. They're trying to tell the police they're getting creepy phone calls. Their friend is missing. They don't know if the two are connected, but they might be connected. There's also another little girl missing, which is an entirely separate story.
This is a fucking spider's web of a story, man.
But it's proof positive that there is so much going on here that the film is spinning plates.
Yes.
And it's doing such a great job because the characters are just doing things like step by step, like, oh, they're having a search party, so we're going to go do a search party. But like, oh, now they're tapping the phone, so we're tapping the phone. Like, you are pivoting through all of these different storylines. Then we go see Jess and tell Peter that she doesn't want to keep the baby. Like, you are transported through all of these different storylines, and you don't know which ones are going to help you figure out who the murderer is upstairs.
Aren't you kind of surprised every time you watch this movie that it works? Like, don't you think that this could, there's like a few wrong decisions and this would just be a boring movie that doesn't know what to focus on?
Every time I watch this movie, I leave thinking like, wow, I think this might be one of my favorite horror films of all time. Like, I think this is the best slasher ever. And then I completely forget about it again. And then next Christmas we watch it. I'm like, wow, I think this is the best horror movie ever. It is
yeah.
so fucking good.
I know. It has such a weird ability to just last for the season, you know, and then it's gone. It's probably because you only watch it once a year. Like Scream, you can watch anytime you want.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's.
I always forget the ending of this movie.
This one.
Yes, I never remember it.
You know what's fucking funny is there was a key moment in the movie that I had forgotten. And like, I've seen this 100 times, easily. But like, there's a moment where she's having a really twisted, creepy phone call with the guy, with the moaner, the guy on the phone. And he's saying back verbatim key moments of a conversation that she had with Peter in the house earlier that night. And so like, in some sense, you're like, oh shit, is that Peter on the phone? And like, I just always forget about that. And there's no way that it just always went by and I missed it, because there's whole conversations with Phyllis about, like, oh, well, he couldn't be Peter. That definitely wasn't Peter on the phone. So, like you, it just, whoop, just, like, it pops out of my head as soon as I'm done watching it.
That is a really great moment. Maybe it's too early to talk about, like, the implications of that scene.
Oh, we'll get to it.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
This is a good movie.
The person that I feel bad about more and more every year,
it's Claire's dad.
Is Claire's dad, yes, and Barb. Because Barb gets the first phone call. There's a lot of information in this movie, key plot details, over the phone. Okay, that's maybe not a huge surprise. It's the 70s. Nobody had cell phones. Nobody had pagers. Like, it wasn't, everything was happening on the phone or in person. But the first phone call we get is Barb's mom. We don't hear Barb's mom at all. Like, we just see the one side of the conversation with Barb, but she's basically telling her, hey, I'm not spending Christmas with you. It's maybe a week before Christmas. Like, everybody's leaving.
I think it's a couple days before Christmas.
Yeah, 'cause
school's
done.
I would say it's like the 23rd.
That's crazy. So she is just given the sudden news that she's not hanging out with her mom. Her mom is basically dumping her for Christmas, and then she just starts becoming an insufferable drunk for the rest of the movie. And it's just a bummer. Like, at first you think that this is just who Barb is, and Barb's always like this, and she was probably going to be like this whether or not she had Christmas with her mom, and she was just going to be this, but with mom, you know? And I don't think that's true at all. Like, I think she just immediately starts staying drunk all day as soon as she gets that bad phone call from her mom. Because the next day, she's drinking with kids, she's giving kids alcohol. Like, I don't know, we never see what Barb is like before the events of the movie. I don't think she's like this.
Yeah, and I think we separate just how young these characters are. Like, it's a sorority. They're probably ranging from 18 to 21.
Yeah.
Barb is maybe 19 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And her mom is like, fuck you, I'm going to have Christmas with my new husband, is what I picture.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, I'll go skiing with my friends. And I guess a couple of the girls agree to go skiing with her. It's kind of just like side little conversations, but she's going to be spending Christmas alone.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's sad.
That is sad. She does have good friends, though, because by all accounts, Phil, who is supposed to be spending time with her boyfriend. They were going to go to a cabin. Like, he's the guy who's playing Santa in this. It's pretty funny. He's only got, like, a couple scenes, but he's real bummed out because, like, it sounds like he had planned this, like, romantic Christmas cabin getaway that's now ruined because Phil's too good of a friend to leave Barb alone on Christmas.
Phil is really the understated MVP of this movie.
Yeah.
The great thing about watching movies like this over and over and over again is you get to watch different characters more than you would have on, like, the first or second watch.
Yeah.
And I had a real great time just, like, appreciating Phil as a friend when we watched it this time.
Yeah. Did you know she was, like, last-minute casting?
Wow.
Now, here's the crazy thing. So, Phyllis, is played by Andrea Martin, who is the only character who comes back in Black Xmas, the 2006 one. Not her character, because obviously Phil's dead by the end of the movie. R.I.P. Phil. But she comes back and plays the house mother in Black Xmas. Whenever I've talked to people about who Andrea Martin is, like, usually I'll say, like, oh, she's the kooky aunt from My Big Fat Greek Wedding, who's like, what do you mean you don't eat meat? But if anybody I'm talking to is, like, a big comedy nerd or, like, loves Saturday Night Live, I always say that Andrea Martin, because she also was on SCTV, is kind of like Canada's...
Canadian.
Yes. Is Canada's Gilda Radner. And turns out Gilda Radner was fucking cast in the role as Phyllis.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but it's just like she couldn't get out of some sort of commitment with Saturday Night Live, and so she couldn't end up coming up to Canada from New York, so they replaced her with Andrea Martin, which is just perfect recasting, and she fucking kills it in this movie. She's great. She's got so much sympathy for what everybody's going through during this Christmas that when she finally turns on Barb, it feels like dad yelling at you.
It does.
Yeah.
She's like disappointed. And
she doesn't even look her in the eye.
It's the only thing that shuts Barb up. She's like, oh, yeah, I should go to bed. Maybe I did drink too much.
Yeah, I think a while and out. Yeah. Yeah. She's like, go to bed, Barb. You're drunk. It's great. But yeah, I get very sad for Barb, and I get very sad for Claire's dad. Like Kim mentioned, Claire is the first girl who gets murdered. We see it all in POV. He's the one hiding in the closet. He strangles Claire. He suffocates her with her
dry cleaning bag. That's a great fucking visual.
Yeah.
Just for killer POV being so new. First of all, the movie opens on killer POV.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to ask your theories on this later,
okay.
But we are watching the killer outside. We're getting all the glorious Christmas lights, but we're also seeing the killer, you know, climb up the lattice and into the attic, and that becomes his lair for the rest of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He kills Claire first. She's in her room packing because she's meeting her dad the next morning, and he's hiding in some plastic bags in her closet, and we see him attack her from the plastic bags.
Yeah.
It's such a creepy visual, especially because the rest of the movie, Claire becomes this haunting vignette that we keep cutting back to.
Yes.
Because he keeps her tied up in the plastic in a rocking chair in the attic.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like in the window. Like, you could see her from the street.
You can see her from the street.
If you just knew she was there. Which is crazy because, like, we're all looking for her. Everybody's, you know, on a huge hunt to find Claire. Everybody's worried about her. And every time we come back to the house, the first thing we see is her dead body up in the attic. The fucking dry cleaning bag still sort of, like, sucked into her throat when she took her last breath. It's so fucked.
It is. It's dark, too. And it's, like, Christmas and she's, like, wearing plastic wrap. Like, it's just, like,
It's great. So that actress, apparently, just surprise casting because she's a really accomplished swimmer at the time. So she could hold her breath for very long and had no problem not blinking. Because she would have to suck in to keep the plastic taut inside of her mouth. And she was just really good at being a dead body.
Wow. But that's so dark. When we go cut to the next morning and we're with her father and she doesn't meet him when she's supposed to meet him. We already know she's dead.
Yes. And he's, like, doing all these sort of, like, fun, you know, funny meetings with the house mother and seeing what his daughter's bedroom is like and how, like, oh, she's, I don't know if this is the, I don't know if this is the right house for
all
my
of this
daughter.
Hippie stuff.
Yeah, all
and
this
boys.
Hippie stuff and boys. Yeah, he's starting to get a bad impression of what the house mother's been letting them get away with. And there's all of these funny little moments, but we know there are dead bodies literally above them the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And so dad also comes into town at a time where a stranger, a woman who we have never seen anywhere in the rest of the movie, is at the police station trying to file a missing report for her daughter.
Her 13-year-old daughter.
And later in the movie, like, because they're all looking for Claire. They're at the police station trying to say, like, hey, this girl's missing. She was supposed to meet her dad.
They're trying to get them to take
station.
It seriously.
Yeah.
Because they, one, assume she's just run off with her boyfriend. But when her boyfriend shows up and is like, I haven't heard from her. I haven't seen her.
As far as I knew, she's meeting her dad today.
Then the sorority girls, the boyfriend and the dad are going and they're like, our friend is missing.
Yeah. So on top of that, we've got this missing girl who's 13 and they're hosting seems like the wrong word, but they've gathered together as a search party.
Like an official search party. They've got dogs. They've got snowmobiles. They've got police officers. Like, this is an organized search party.
Yeah. And everybody from the sorority is there, including Claire's boyfriend and her dad, to look for this missing girl. Now, the, you know, unfortunate thought is that maybe they'll also find Claire. But there's something maybe Canadian about everybody getting together to just help out this stranger to find her daughter.
There's so much just meat to chew on as a filmmaker there that if you cut just this little storyline, this my daughter is missing, I'm meeting her friends and her boyfriend for the first time as she's missing, I'm in the city where she's gone to school, there's another girl missing, it's winter, like the weather is bad, we're doing the search for two missing girls.
Right.
I could watch that movie. You don't even need the killer upstairs.
Like, we get maybe 10 seconds, maybe less, where they discover, we never see it, but we discover the body of this 13-year-old girl. Claire's dad sees this body before the mother comes running up. I fucking love that moment, because, like,
there's a little bit of relief in his eyes.
That
and
it's not,
the guilt of it being like, yay, it's not my daughter, but then him being there right as the mother discovers it's her daughter.
Yeah.
And but she's 13.
But
and
he's there with her too. Like, he doesn't do that standard movie thing, like, oh, you don't want to see this. You don't want to see it. He lets her see her daughter. Like, it's I don't know. It's a complicated moment. Cause it's like he doesn't shield her from it, but then he's also there to, like, hold her afterward. It's great. You're right. That's a whole movie right there. Like, a character who's looking for their missing daughter who helps somebody else find their missing daughter's body. That's just a story.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the complicated thing there, too, is that, one, we did not know that the 13-year-old girl was dead.
No.
We did know that the sorority girl was
dead.
That's
the other crazy thing. Like, we know the fate of so many people, but we're invested in this girl we've never met
before.
But,
like, we know that they have more in common in that moment than he does.
Oh.
So, like, there's just so many, psychologically, there's just so many layers there that you're like, why are we doing a horror movie right now? We have enough movie right here. That's what's so good about this movie.
God, I love this
movie. I could just watch The Search Party. The fucking fur coats are just to die for.
Yeah, no, like, you like fur coats, this one's for you. Like, I don't know.
Chris's coat is just...
He looks like he's wearing a whole bear.
He's just living his best winter life.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Now, I was going to come out with this at the beginning of the podcast. I think these girls live in the most dangerous neighborhood of the city. Like, whether it's set in Toronto or Chicago or Detroit or just, like, in the middle of Indiana somewhere, I think this is the most dangerous neighborhood in the world.
Why?
Because let's not forget that at the beginning of the movie, we don't know that the moaner, the person calling, is the killer.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a guy who's making very creepy calls, like calls that are gross.
Obscene.
Obscene. That's the word I was looking for. But then also, man, there's that fucking chilling moment in that first phone call where he's like, he's making all his dumb noise, like, and like saying obscene stuff he wants to do to them.
Oh, when he gets lucid and he's like, when I'm going to kill you.
Right. Just like right before he hangs up. It's very calm and he's very present and he's mincing no words about it. But just, like, almost like he's stating a matter of a fact. Like, I'm going to kill you. And that's horrifying. Like, so we've got a serial killer on the phone, number one. Number two, we've got a serial killer in the house. We don't know that they're connected. And I might fight you on it at the end of it. I'm not sure. They might not be. They might not be fucking connected at all. They probably are. Anyway, so we've got these two pieces here. We've got somebody in the neighborhood who has abducted, and we later find out killed, a 13-year-old girl. Then we've also got Jess's boyfriend, Peter. Now, this is just like regular domestic...
Who's just a douche.
He's a huge douche. And is maybe possibly capable of murder. There are so many dangers in the air for these girls on Christmas at their sorority.
But the thing too, though, is that all of those four things could be related.
Maybe. Now, the other
could be
the other big coincidence of this whole thing. Maybe just like works out in their favor.
You know, the simplest explanation is probably the correct one.
Okay.
And that the simplest explanation is that they're not coincidences.
No, I mean, it's not a coincidence. I mean, I used the wrong word.
I'm just saying that I think the killer killed a 13-year-old girl.
Something to factor in here is that they also have maybe the most efficient police department I've ever seen in my entire fucking life.
There's only like four cops, and they're doing a great job.
There's only four cops, they're working around the clock, and every single thing that gets brought into their station, they're just like, well, this is obviously top priority number one. Like, we have a sergeant at the beginning.
It's because it's John Saxon. Did you have any questions?
Yeah. Like, John Saxon's just like, I'm the dad of this police station, and everything's getting fucking taken care of,
goddammit.
Fall
in line, gentlemen.
They've got a sergeant who's doing triage at the front of the station who seems a little overworked. He is way more crammed than the rest of the department by the looks of it.
And he gets all the grief.
He gets all the grief. But a woman comes in who says that her daughter has been missing for a couple hours. Now, obviously, she knows something's up. But I don't think you'd ever see the police department jump into action and get a search party going by sundown. On top of that, they're also looking for Claire. Like, it's not just the one girl that they're looking for. They are taking the Claire thing seriously. The sorority girls are like, we're getting weird phone calls. They're like, well, shit, we better get a guy on that, too. We don't have enough on our plate. Fuck it. You know, as soon as a problem comes across their desk, they're just like, well, we better roll up our sleeves, boys. You know, like, it is unlike any police department you've ever heard of in your entire life. Now, I have a theory about the killer.
Okay.
But I think we're overdue for a quick break, so I'm going to take a quick little breather here. I'm going to collect my thoughts, and in the meantime, Kim's going to regale you with her Christmas tap dance.
All right. I prepared a little ditty.
Yeah. What do you call this piece, Kim?
Starry night. No. Oh, holy night. Oh, Christmas night.
Oh, boy.
Oh, black Christmas night.
Take it away, Kim. Look at her go. Oh, my God, she's on the table. How does she do it?
Christmas. I'm done now. I'm finished.
Marvelous. Marvelous. Bravo. Really, truly a variety show like we promised. Okay, so I got a wild theory.
Okay, what's your wild theory?
I got a crazy theory that I thought it might be fun to toss across the desk, volley over to you, see what you think. Now, this also comes from seeing the movie in 2023, and movies nowadays, no one gets a line of dialogue unless they're coming back. Movies in the 70s, you would just get extras, you'd get people who say nothing, but like today you would never pay a person a full day's wage to say maybe 10 lines of dialogue and then never come back in a movie. Like, they're just not important whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take that into consideration.
Because you're like, oh, now we're in union territory.
It's a whole thing. I mean, this is and I hate to ruin modern movies for you guys, but if you're watching a whodunit and there's a character who you've only seen once and then they disappeared, chances are they're coming back and they're taking off a mask at the end of the movie. That's just how it goes. Nobody has one line of dialogue and then disappears forever like they do in a 70s movie. But when we're first introduced to Claire's dad, he gets hit in the face with a snowball. And a 20-ish year old guy who's clearly a university student comes up and apologizes. Hey, man, I'm real sorry. I should have been watching those kids a little better. You know, he picks up his glasses, brushes the snow off his jacket, is a little snippy with him.
He's a little snippy, but then he's helpful.
But then he's helpful. I think he might be the killer.
Why?
I have no reason.
He's working.
Possibly. But here's the thing. One, like I said, he's got a line of dialogue. He's got to be integral to the plot in some small way. On top of that, he knows where the sorority house is. This random stranger just like, hello, you wouldn't happen to know where my daughter, Claire Harrison, is? Like, oh, Claire Harrison, part of the Pi Kappa Beta family? Yeah, of course, that's right down here. You just cut through the path. He knows how to get there. He probably almost had to restrain himself from saying, like, by the way, the attic door is unlocked if you want to just walk in from the lattice outside. I would say that Mr. Harris is at the school around, I don't know, maybe noon, and this guy, after meeting Claire's dad, because he's a sadistic fuck, I don't think he knows exactly who he is, but he would have known that Claire was going to meet her dad, right? Because he probably saw somewhere in her room.
This is a huge stretch,
I'm not
buying
it's so
any
fun.
Of this.
And then I think on the way home, back to the attic, into his lair, he kills a girl in the park. Now, the other thing that I want to point out, he does have a similar haircut to Peter.
So, the thing about this movie is that it's the 70s, uh-huh, and everybody had a brown shag haircut. Every single male in this movie under the age of 50 has a shag haircut, which is maybe why Peter is thought to be Billy, and also why Chris looks kind of like Peter and kind of like Billy.
I don't know about that. I don't think that he hunt. Does he kind of look like Chris? I guess he does kind of look like Chris. He doesn't really look like Phil's boyfriend. Phil's boyfriend has a afro. But I mean, he's got a similar shag to Peter. He definitely, and like, I think the person that kills Barb, we see very little of them, but we see enough of a silhouette that it really kind of looks like Peter.
It does really kind of look like
Peter. It might be this stranger who threw the fucking snowball.
No, it's not.
Nah, it might be. I really think it might be.
It was a little kid that threw the snowball.
Here's the other thing about this movie, and I looked very closely, and I have screen caps. I got receipts. I got evidence. You want to see it? I got it. Everybody wears the exact same clothing throughout the whole second half of this movie. Now, obviously, Jess has her fun sweater with the big old fingerprints
on it. She's not wearing that in the second half.
No. Because it's the second half, she's wearing a completely different outfit. Nobody gets changed, is what I'm saying.
Because it's all one day.
Because it's all one... If it was all one day in 2023, there'd still be four outfit changes. Don't fucking lie to yourself.
Okay. What's the point?
All I'm saying is that the one glimpse we get of the killer at the end is when he grabs Jess's hair. Mm-hmm. And we can see that he's wearing a black sweater. Now, Peter is wearing a green sweater. I made very sure to note that down. We just see like his hand and just like a little bit of the cuff of his sweater. That kid who threw that snowball, black sweater.
Okay.
Underneath his jacket. He is also wearing
a white dress. You solved
the crime. I solved it, baby. I fucking knew it.
Great.
You hated every minute of this.
No, he was just a side character. He helped.
Of course he was.
He helped that man find the sorority house.
It was fun to pretend like I solved the crime.
No. Okay, so back on theories, though. The yeah. very beginning of the movie, we are in killer POV. We are watching the killer outside the house, being all creepy, looking mm-hmm. in the windows. There's a party going on inside. He's climbing up the lattice into the attic. Then we cut into the house, and the front door is not closed properly.
Yeah.
And, you know, somebody's like, oh, we gotta get this door fixed, la la la.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the killer was already inside?
Oh, and you think the killer POV is somebody else entirely? Is that what you're thinking?
I think the killer was already in the attic, came down to snoop, went outside to use that opportunity to look at them through the windows, and then go back in through the lattice.
So you think he's been living in the attic for a while?
I think so.
Interesting. I never thought about that. I did this time around try to take note of that door. It might even just be like, there's a couple things in this movie where I think it's just there to sort of add a little bit of like, oh, well, opportunity exists here. Like, it's not 100% pointing a finger at anybody in particular, mm-hmm. but it could be this person. The same way that there's a lot of evidence that it could be Peter who's killing the girls. I don't know if that's entirely true, but I'm also not sure if I want to fully let Peter off the hook for everything. That's a great question. I'm going to say sure.
I think it is interesting that the door is open already. And it is creepy in that way that, like, he could have just barged right in the front door
absolutely.
And been in the middle of their soiree.
Yeah.
That's not the kind of killer he is, but...
No, but it is... It maybe does... I don't know.
It adds a level of vulnerability.
Yeah, like, they're... Not everybody's paying attention to whether the door is locked or not. There's so many people in the house. There's so much going on that you could get away with anything. Somebody could actually slip by without anybody noticing. In the same way that, like, I don't think you would... Every night before going to bed, make sure that the attic windows are closed and locked. But, you know, somebody probably opened it in the summer to get a little bit of breeze in there and then forgot to close it and it's been open ever since.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good idea. I like what you're saying there.
Mm-hmm.
The second half of this movie I find fascinating and frustrating because there are so many plates spinning. There's so many balls in the air. There's so many possibilities for who the killer could be.
But not really.
Well, so...
It's Peter or it's not Peter.
The other thing is, like, is it just human nature, because we're watching a movie, to think that the person who killed the girl in the park is the same person who's killing these girls in the sorority house? Like, it is possible and probably likely that that's a completely separate story altogether.
It is possible.
That has nothing. Do you think it's actually the person who's responsible for this stuff? Like, or do you think it's a separate story?
I think it makes more...
Right? It's tough.
No, but it's probably a better assumption to assume that they are related. Like, I think the more sensible assumption would be that all of the crimes happening that are alike because they are of the same.
But that's because you're watching a movie, you know? Like, I think Bob Clark is coming at this from a real life point of view, where I think it's just coincidence that these two awful murders, several awful murders are happening right next to each other.
I think it is coincidence because somebody who wants to kill a 13-year-old is different than somebody who wants to kill, like, a 19-year-old.
Yeah. And so we know that Peter goes off the deep end when Jess says that she doesn't want to keep this baby. He's a fascinating character. And, you know, frankly, I don't think we have enough time to necessarily go into, like, every detail about him.
He's such a well-written character and performed. Like, he's got he seems very high strung, very neurotic. He's got a lot going for him. He's putting a lot of pressure on himself, on their relationship. There's just a lot happening for him right now.
Oh yeah, he feels like he has the weight of the world on his fucking shoulders.
And he's also a dick.
He's a dick, and he's looking for the easiest way out at some point, because he's been grinding in this fucking school, in this conservatory, to be a concert pianist, and I think he's finally realizing that maybe he's not cut out for it, or maybe he's not good enough. And so this is such good news. It's not that I'm not good enough to be the dream that I had for myself. It's that I chose to give it up to start a family.
It's like he thinks he's been handed this, like, a life raft that throw all of his excuses on.
Yeah.
And that's not what she wants.
No, it's not what she wants. And I think even if she wanted the baby, I think she'd be smart enough to realize that waiting for her down the road is a lifetime of resentment, where he's eventually going to either resent her or the baby for taking away his dreams. Like, oh, I had such a great life ahead of me, but because I got chained to this baby and this girl, I'll never be the concert pianist I know I could have been. Like, 100%, that's probably who he'd end up being.
Mm.
And then it's great because he crumbles when she takes that away from him. Because she comes out saying, I'm pregnant and I don't want to keep it. And he's just like, so you're pregnant, eh? One of the best lines of dialogue one of the best line deliveries in the whole movie is where they're just going down this, like, plinko board of, like, well, I don't want that and I definitely don't want this. And, like, all those dreams that I said I have.
Oh, it's one of my favorite lines of the whole movie.
Olivia Hussey's incredible in this movie.
So good.
And she does that compliment sandwich thing where she's like, I'm not talking about myself right now. I'm talking about you.
Like, remember when we had all of these dreams and we got together and you wanted to be an accomplished pianist? I also had dreams and I still have those dreams.
Yeah, and I'm not ready to give up on them. And then, so, like, he's seeing all, like, her just, like, slap away all of these, like, things that he's presenting to her as, like, this is what our future could be like, and we could do this, and I'll be so happy, and, like, we'll be together. And then he's like, once he's realized that she's saying no to all of that, he's like, okay, what about the baby? Like, he's still just like, the baby's still on the table, and that's not going away. I'm not letting you kill that. And she's steadfast in it. She's like, no, I'm getting an abortion. There's nothing you can do about it. It's not really up for debate. Like, I'm kind of letting you know as a courtesy.
This here presents an interesting, I guess, little wrench in the it's Peter as the killer, because she doesn't tell Peter until the next day.
Mm-hmm.
At the conservatory.
And Claire has already been killed.
And Claire has already been murdered. Claire was murdered at the party the night before.
Yeah. Now.
And we've seen killer POV, unless the killer POV is lying, which killer POV does not lie.
No, never has, never will.
Killer POV does not lie. The killer has been already creeping about the attic.
Yeah.
Is active in the house, calling girls, killing at least one of them.
Yeah.
Before Peter is given his quote-unquote motive.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right in that sense.
But
before the big conversation, lots of buts here, before their big conversation in the house where he realizes that she's really not backing down on this, he's creeping up behind her in the house.
He was in the house. He was upstairs.
Yeah.
When he was in the house upstairs when a phone call was happening.
Yes.
A creepy phone call.
Yeah, he can hear she's having, and he creeps down behind her. We don't even know it's him at first. We just see footsteps.
We think maybe it's the killer. And his excuse is like, oh, I was having a nap upstairs. And you're just like, that's fucking creepy.
Kind of seems like you... So you just let yourself in? And also, door was unlocked, huh?
That's definitely one of the moments that leans to him the most as the killer.
Yes, absolutely. That and the fact that he does call back And well, one of the phone calls with the moaner is saying the same words back to her that Peter has said, like, I'm not going to let you kill this baby, you know? And like, he says that back to her in his weird fucked up moaner voice. And it really puts her off guard because that makes her think that it's Peter. She's not willing to admit it yet. And she doesn't want to tell the cops that because she doesn't want them to just sort of go after Peter without evidence for it. But those are the exact words that Peter said.
Which presents two things. Either the killer is upstairs and heard, or the killer is Peter.
Yes. Now,
It proves that the killer was present for that conversation.
And Peter does call back. One of the other phone calls we get, not from the moaner, from Peter, who's distraught and sounds unlike Peter normally. He's similar to the moaner, but he's...
I have to say, all of the males, when they call, sound like... the killer.
Yeah.
They're all guilty.
Every single one of them bad.
Even when John Saxon calls, I'm like, it's the killer.
But, okay, so we've got all of these, like, we're really painting a picture for it possibly being Peter. And we don't know where Peter is. Peter has left without his coat. He's left off in a huff. We very clearly see somebody kill Barb while she's upstairs, passed out drunk, and it looks just like Peter.
Okay, so now I'm not in the Peter camp necessarily, but an argument for what I was saying earlier about the motive, mm-hmm. because he didn't know about the baby yet.
Yeah.
He potentially didn't know about the baby yet. We also see that he is under a lot of pressure with the school stuff.
Yeah.
We know he's got, like, that penultimate audition, which he does terrible at, and he breaks a baby grand about it.
He destroys, thousands of dollars piano.
Yeah. And it's definitely the school's property.
It's not his.
Yeah. Also, because we've come into their lives so abruptly, and we don't get a complete download of their relationship beforehand, she's definitely made up her mind that she doesn't want this baby. So we should assume that their relationship maybe hasn't been as good for very long,
yeah.
especially while he's been maybe high strung through these finals or whatever he's going through.
Mm-hmm.
Her pregnancy has also kind of put things into perspective for her that she doesn't see him as a lifelong partner. She doesn't want to marry him.
Yeah.
What if he's already kind of got that inkling and in a way murdering everyone around her might scare her into his arms?
Oh, what a psychopathic way of
being somebody. I'm just saying, if one wanted to make a motive for Peter, one
yeah.
could.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The great thing about the Peter problem is that he does some things at the end of the movie that truly don't make sense.
He
does some things that a murderer might, okay? Now, first off, I gotta ask you, there is a police officer on guard outside of the sorority house who we later reveal has had his throat slashed.
Yeah.
Who did that?
Right.
Yeah. Because we also...
Why didn't Peter see it when he came up to the house?
Right? There's some great questions here. Now... We are watching the killer's movements a lot in the sorority house once Phil is there with Jess and Barb's upstairs asleep. Like, they're alone. The phones have been tapped, so the police aren't there. They're back at the police station. They're actually trying to find Peter at one point. They discover the smashed piano where he literally kills his own future because there's no fucking way they're going to let him stay in the conservatory. Like,
no.
This is the death nail in the coffin of the entire future that he has planned himself, and that's why he's hanging everything on that baby that she doesn't want to have.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a pretty good chance that he kills that cop because he needs to get back into the house and he can't have anybody stopping him and he can't have anybody seeing him. We see the killer's movements throughout the house a lot. There's actually, this time around, I think you and I finally saw like a shadow of a person behind Jess and Phil that they don't see, that there's somebody skulking around listening to
yeah.
their conversation.
I don't know if that's like a continuity error.
You think it's
or
a
what
crew member?
I honestly, we're not given enough for me to definitively make a conclusion there, but there is movement behind Phil's head.
Okay, so Jess gets the phone call from the police saying the calls are coming from inside the house. We finally traced the phone calls. You need to get out of the goddamn house now. Do not go and save Barb. Do not save Phil. Do not pass go. Just get outside.
Oh, her performance there is so fucking good.
It's
when
incredible,
she's screaming
right?
desperately for them, but she's like clinging kind of to the safety of the inside of the door.
Yep.
And she's pleading for them to respond and they don't. Oh,
it's hard.
It kills me. It's very hard.
It's the one time somebody goes upstairs in a killer movie where you're just like, yeah, we're with you, baby. You go up there.
You're such a a good friend.
Yeah, she's great. But that's where she sees their dead bodies. She encounters the killer. She doesn't see him. She just sees his eyeball through the crack of a door. And she hears him go, "It's me, Agnes. It's Billy." And, she hits him with the door and tries to run off. That's, again, where we see his hand. She locks herself in the basement. He can't get through the door. And while she's finding a spot to hide, we do hear some footsteps upstairs, and then it gets quiet. So the killer has kind of disappeared, maybe possibly left the house. And then, at the exact same time, Peter is trying to get in through a window in the basement. He's asking for Jess. Like, "Jess, are you in there?" Like, why would he think she's in the basement?
I know.
It's not a finished basement. It is like a crawl space of a basement, the way basements used to be. It's just a fucking storage space full of junk. And he's like looking for her, he's asking for her, and then he kicks the window in. Like he breaks the window and gets inside, and then he's still all sort of like lovey-dovey concerned when he finds Jess. Like, "Oh, Jess, what are you doing down here?
Why aren't you answering me?
Why aren't you answering me? Are you okay?" Like something is wrong about what's happening. And, he kind of lunges out for her when we cut away, and when the police find her, she has beaten him to death with the fire poker that she's taken from the fireplace.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the end of the movie, she's in shock, she's passed out, everybody leaves.
We glide through the house and we see, like, all the scenes of the crime, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, the cops are pretty certain that it was Peter, she killed the attacker, she killed the killer, everything's great, everything's fine, but we hear footsteps upstairs, we hear the whispers of Billy, and we hear the phone ringing again, because he is not gone, he's still in the house. Everything's quiet except for that killer mouse. And nothing's been resolved. Like, all that's happened is that she's, like, a bunch of her friends have died. She killed Peter.
And they haven't found the bodies upstairs.
They haven't found the house mother. They haven't found Claire.
Are still in the attic.
Claire's father is still there, and he passes out from shock in all of it. Because I think, he's definitely...
It's dawning on him.
That his daughter is most likely dead. Somebody is clearly targeting the girls of the sorority house, and, it's just a matter of time before I find my daughter's body. I think... None of this is connected. I think the girl in the park is a separate story. Mm-hmm. I think Peter's a separate story. Mm-hmm. And obviously I don't think he is quote unquote Billy. I don't think he actually killed anybody except maybe the cop. Like, Peter may have killed the cop in order to gain access to the house.
I think that might be a stretch. I think it's a fun theory.
It's a fun theory. Oh, you think it was just somebody who was just like, "Fuck coppers"? Like,
was probably Billy.
I mean, it's likely that it was Billy. It seems improbable, but it's possible.
But you could also present at the end that Billy is not actually in the attic, and it's just like film, like it's the end of Friday the 13th Part 1.
Oh, I don't know.
I like playing that because Jess is alone and she's sedated, and now you're like, "Oh fuck!" Like it's not over.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of it all being disconnected. I really do think Peter was going to kill her. Like, I think Peter was coming into the house and he was going to kill Jess. I think he was crazy and jealous, and he wasn't going... Because he's like, "If you kill this baby, you're going to regret it. You're like something's going to happen." Like, he's really... There's a darkness about Peter with this.
Especially once you've kind of put into perspective him breaking the piano. Like, when I watch it, I'm like, "Oh, what an overreaction." But you're so right. He's kicked out of school for this.
Yeah.
His career is not, like, him failing is not career ending.
No.
Him failing is a setback.
Yes.
Him behaving the way he did is career ending.
That's the end. You're like, that's it. Like, this is like getting face tattoos. So you're like, "I'm never getting a day job. I'm going to be a musician or I'm going to die trying." You know?
I'm a musician or a criminal.
Yeah.
Or a tattoo artist.
Yeah. Or both. I could be all three, frankly. I really do think that if it wasn't for the other girls around her being murdered, Jess would have been killed. Like, let's say in a perfect world where none of the other sorority girls have been killed and that girl in the park never died.
I love that idea.
I think Peter would have killed Jess, and the only reason she survived is because of everything else that's been happening.
It's because she's on guard because of another killer.
Which she thinks might be Peter. That's the other thing. So, wow. I mean, don't get me wrong. There is a chance that Peter's getting into the house and it's actually
innocent.
If she
wasn't afraid of a killer, she wouldn't have reacted to him being that way at all.
No, not at all. The only thing that saved her life is the fact that all of her friends are dead.
So, no, the only thing that saved her life is the fact that there are potentially two killers after her.
Oh, that's true. Because in that moment, Peter is going to kill her.
Fuck. I love that. I love thinking that there are two killers in that moment.
In that moment, there definitely are. Maybe even three.
Oh, fuck. That's good.
Yeah, this is such a great movie. Like, it's
the weirdest thing is, like, I've seen this movie at least 30 times, and the fact that we're having these conversations is crazy.
Well, also that you don't find it frustrating. It's not that you watch the movie and it's frustrating that it's never opened itself up to you or that you've never cracked the code on it. It's like, I will never solve the movie, but I'm fascinated every single time I watch it. Like,
yeah.
It is such a great magic trick of a whodunit. And that, like, you're never going to know how it was done, where exactly everybody was, and it all fits together so perfectly.
Yeah, and you're never going to understand the calls from the killer.
No.
As much as you want to.
And as much as Black Xmas tried.
So that's the thing, too, is watching it now retroactively, having watched Black Xmas 2006, it's so hard not to impose that story on the phone calls.
It's like trying to forget that Michael and Lori are brother and sister,
It's so hard to just be like, okay, I need to hear what is actually being said about, like, Agnes and Billy and what we did and who are you, and you're trying to put a narrative in it.
Yeah.
In the same way that, you know, you see faces in everything. Like, you're trying to put a narrative to these phone calls.
But that's also why I think maybe it's everything is completely disconnected, because, like, as a person watching a movie, you're trying to put a narrative to it. Like, okay, so the killer killed this 13-year-old girl after killing Claire, and then he came here, and then he did this, and it's like we're trying to connect that all together when I think it is just all happenstance. Like, it's all coincidence that it's happening together at the same time.
There are just three killers
in
this movie.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. What a dangerous neighborhood. The most dangerous neighborhood on campus.
In reality, it's a gated community, because we drove up there and we definitely snuck in.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They do not want you to go up there and see their pretty house.
It's beautiful. It looks exactly the same. And they decorate for Christmas.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Yeah.
What an incredible movie. 4 out of 4 across the board, right?
Wow. Whose death hurts you the most?
That's tough. I mean, like, I don't know. I want to say Claire, because she never gets discovered, and you just see so many people worried for her and looking for her, but it's probably Phil.
Phil's is hard, because she's just going to check on Barb.
Yeah.
And we don't see it, and it's sudden, and...
Yeah. Barb sucks, too, because she's just, like, asleep. And if her mom wasn't a bitch, like, she probably wouldn't be there. None of them would be there. That's the other thing, right?
She wouldn't be asleep, because she wouldn't have been over drinking.
Yeah.
She wouldn't have been sad drinking. She would have been happy drinking. I think the scene of them finding the 13-year-old girl is just like peak cinema.
Oh my God.
It's so good.
It's all just in expressions, right? It's like, you just from what you know about these people and how they react, and it's all so quick. Oh, he's a great filmmaker, you know? Did you know?
I wish he did more dark stuff, because from the two, like, these two films that we've watched together, they really delve into psychology and, like, the human condition in such an interesting way that I just want more. I just want to consume, like, give me things to pontificate about.
I want Bob Clark to ruin my afternoon. Did you know that during development, the studio, Warner Brothers, tried to get him to write a scene where Chris, Claire's boyfriend, goes up to Jess while she's asleep at the end of the movie and says, "Don't tell him what we did, Agnes," and then kills Jess?
No!
And then it's revealed that Chris was the killer the whole time?
Wow.
And he fought for it. He said, "No, we need to have an ambiguous ending. This is like... The end of
Chris
this
in that coat, he's not the
in
murderer.
That coat,
in that coat, in that hockey game."
Yeah, with her dad. No, yeah, that's what the studio wanted. They wanted a clean end to it, right? And you got to assume that, like, even after the movie was made, he probably still had to continue that fight. They're like, "Nope, I think you should go back in and do some reshoots." And he was like, "Absolutely fucking not." And thank God he didn't, because this movie's perfect.
Mm. Does that mean that Chris is potentially... I never suspect Chris.
No.
To be fair, I don't ever really suspect Peter. I just think he's fucking creepy. And when he's in the basement, you're just like, why are you doing this?
No, like, the movie... There's the occasional moment where, like, the movie's building a case against Peter. They're making it possible for it to be Peter. But ultimately, it could just as easily not. Like, you're like, oh, you know, he's going through his own thing. It's separate from this. You know, if there weren't a whole bunch of murders going on, he would just be overreacting and a little emo.
Yeah, I just think...
Except for when he comes in the fucking basement window.
The killer having to juggle sneaking around upstairs and getting to the other phone line and murdering somebody and also not being seen is enough job for him to do.
Yeah.
Versus, like, playing a concert score and, like, going and breaking a piano and then, like... trying to convince his girlfriend to keep her baby. That's too much for Billy to, like, float.
Hey, man, if this was the year 2001, absolutely, it would have been fine. Like, everybody had multiple personalities. They were... The productivity level of murderers in the early 2000 horror movies was insane. They were doing everything.
Fast travel.
And that's gonna do it for this week's edition of the Bob Clark Creepy Christmas Spooktacular. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been a hoot. It's definitely the strangest variety show I've ever been part of.
I apologize if our talk on the film was very disjointed. It is hard to talk about a movie you've seen 100 times without getting into, like, the minutia of it.
Oh, yeah,
and
no.
And not going, like, I don't think we went through the plot at all, so if you're not too familiar with the film, you're like,
sorry for that.
What the fuck are they talking about?
You're like, oh, shit, they brought up the red yarn and the board. Like, we went full JFK conspiracy theory on this one.
So hopefully you watched the film before you listened to this.
Yeah, let us know what you think of Black Christmas. Like, what's your definitive version of Black Christmas? Like, I don't care if you like the new Blumhouse Black Christmas. Which one's your favorite?
I mean, you're wrong, but you can tell us.
I will. You are absolutely wrong, but I will not make fun of you for it.
Yeah, we're not mean about it.
Like what you like.
I like the 2006 version.
I think it's great.
I don't keep them in the same spot in my head.
No.
Like, they're not in the same filing cabinet, but it's in a cabinet.
Yeah, it's like trying. It's like talking about. I filed it away.
I didn't pretend it didn't exist.
Yeah, no. Let us know what you thought of Bob Clark's Black Christmas. Like, whether this is a movie that you rewatch constantly. Honestly, as long as you revisit a Black Christmas every Christmas, I think that is the most any horror fan can hope for. I think there are perfect Christmas movies. I think two of them, at the very least, are perfect Christmas movies. And yeah, I'm never, ever, ever going to get sick of watching this movie. And just, it hooks me immediately. Like, I know all the beats. I know all the characters. I know everything about the movie. And I'm always, like, putting on my detective hat. Like, ooh, no, we're going to get to the bottom of it this time.
And you can watch a different character every single time you watch the movie. Like,
yeah.
You can watch it as John Saxon's movie.
Oh, yeah.
You can watch it as Jess's movie. You can watch it as Barb's movie.
Yeah.
You can watch it as Phil's movie. Like, they're such good characters that they could be the entire focus of your attention.
The only version of this movie you should not watch is the Billy version. Now, not like some saying you should watch this movie from Billy's perspective. I'm saying that if you own a Blu-ray copy of this movie, there is an audio commentary with Billy for the full hour and a half, and it's insufferable. Like, it's perfect. It's Billy, all right, but truly, you should get...
I love the idea that maybe he just took over, like, the recording booth.
Yeah, pretty much. He's in character, like Nick Mancuso, in character as Billy throughout the whole fucking thing. And we've tried. It's very hard. You should get, like, a Pizza Hut gift certificate for finishing it. Like, you get, like, a free Scholastic book and a slice of pizza for finishing it. Like, you deserve an award.
Honor system?
Yeah. Like, oh,
nobody
man.
Finishes it.
Yeah, you blow the dust off the gift certificate before you give it to
anybody. It just expires in 1999.
Yeah. Oh, but yeah, that's going to do it for us this holiday season. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. We hope we're having a happy holidays. We hope you've been finding some creepy horror movies to watch. Let us know what you've been watching and what you think of Bob Clark's Black Christmas over in the Nightmare on Film Street Discord at nofspodcast.com/discord. There's a link in the episode description. You don't even have to type anything out. We're going to be back again next Thursday with a apocalyptic year end, maybe possibly life end movie. We're talking about End of Days with Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's going to be great. Kim's been looking forward to this one for a long time. We're going to talk about Gabriel Byrne as Satan. He does an incredible job.
Ooh.
But in our final segment of the variety show, we're going to close out.
I didn't prepare another tab.
We're going to close out with a little selection from the Mormon Tabernacle, from the local Mormon Tabernacle Choir, featuring Black Christmas's own Billy.
but we'll get you next time. Help us to grow the horde. Leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you subscribe. More terror can be found lurking on our website, nofspodcast.com. Until next time, stay creepy, fiends.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy 5 or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.